Hi, everybody. I am a professional cyclist, and I'm going to go with professional logistics officer, Ted King.
Hello, everyone. I am Laura King, sometimes Gravel Pro, and brand and product marketer.
And I am Stu Streeter, age group cyclist and aspiring professional party planner. We've got a bunch of graduations seem to always be going through our house with four kids. So we're always planning another party, it seems.
What party's on the horizon?
Our youngest graduates high school in like 6 weeks.
Wow.
If you could believe that. So graduation party at our house. Are graduation parties, open houses, a big deal out east? They're a big deal on the West Coast.
I feel like there's that sort of an aspect of high school that... So my answer is maybe. I did one with two of my best friends in high school, and I feel like it was almost like you're supposed to go through the routine, so I didn't even really know what was happening. It was like, oh, we're having a party. Oh, Matthew and Jeff, invite your friends. And Ted, you invite your friends. And so I guess not a big deal per se, but it's a thing. It's a thing.
What was it like in Seattle, Laura? Big deal?
It was common. I mean, okay. I had one.
Yeah.
Were they chaperoned?
They were hosted by our parents.
I know. I'm kidding. I'm picturing like a high school rager a la the movies.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, this episode of the podcast, first off, if you're new with us, we are so delighted to have you along on Gravel Kings. This episode, we're talking first races of the year, Valley of the Tears, Mid-South, Grasshopper Adventures, and we're also going to talk maybe a little bit about Berkey, if Ted's up for it.
Oh, my, yes.
And we'll talk... Yes, and we're also going to take listener questions and some other fun stuff. So let's start right with Berkey, Ted. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about Berkey? I should intro by saying I just finally caught up on some YouTubing today and watched your video you put out on YouTube. We should put that in the show notes. It was wonderful. Way to go.
Appreciate it.
You're always wonderful.
I thank you. Yeah, my videos are typically vlog style, which is a term that I don't love, but it's sort of perfect because it's a video blog. The Berkey is the shorthand vernacular for the American Birkebeiner, for those not in the know. And this is a Nordic ski race. I would say the biggest of its kind in North America. It's the biggest, certainly in the United States. I don't know if Canada has such a thing. I know you go over to Scandinavia and Norway and those countries, and they have these events that are, man, people are sending me videos. They're like, oh, there's like 50 to 80,000 people. So here in North America, the American Birkebeiner is an event that I want to say this year is about 15,000 people. And so it's a Nordic ski or Nordic skate event. It's my second go at it. And it is a 50-kilometer event with a couple shorter options. It's basically a five-day affair. It's in Cable, Wisconsin, which people might be aware of because that is also where the Schwamigan mountain bike race takes place. And, yeah, it is just a festival. It is a huge party, for lack of a better word. There's registration, and that is a huge expo with you know, every single person who's participating through the weekend. So some 12,000-15,000 people are coming through there, and then all sorts of events probably kicking off Thursday. And then with the whole interesting piece is that this year it took place with zero natural snow, and it was a really cool exhibit in modern snowmaking, because what I was conveniently lucky to get my hands on was some overhead drone footage, and it's literally just this strip of white snow all through a very brown and barren forest, and they created a 10-kilometer loop, and we were able to ski it I was lucky enough to have done the event once before and skied fast enough to qualify for the elite wave, and that allowed me to ski all five laps of 50K, because there are plenty of people who are doing it as first timers or in a couple of the different waves, and it just looked like a complete and utter cluster, because instead of a couple hundred people on course, it was literally thousands of people on course, and they're skiing over each other, and again, it goes back to like the festival. It's people who are dressed up. I mean, so, you know, there's a great assimilation, great comparison to that of gravel riding, and it takes all kinds, and people are just really happy to be there, especially this year when so much of that northern Midwest area just didn't have snow. So people are just stoked to be on snow.
Did someone mention to you the cost of what it took to get the track, the snow part? Carted in and
yeah, to some degree. I was talking to Keegan Randall, gold medalist, Olympian, a friend of mine, fellow graduate of the Dartmouth Tuck Next Step business program designed for athletes and military personnel. That was a really cool program that we did, what, 3-4 years ago? I forget the number what she said, but yes. Something like 80 truckloads of snow, and each truckload contains whatever, 4,000 cubic feet or something asinine. I think I came home and told you these numbers, I rattled them off, and then immediately, yeah. Now a couple weeks later, I want to say it was like an extra $120,000 of budgeting purely for bringing the trucks in, let alone, you know, running a snowmaking machine for days, presumably.
Man.
Just thinking from a race director perspective, oof, those are costs that right. Probably 10 years ago they weren't thinking about that needed to be added to the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as people who have planned an event or two in your life, can you imagine just an extra 120K
on top? Yeah, that's an expensive line item.
It is, and it's nutty. I mean, they're to their credit, I don't entirely know what it means, but they are a nonprofit. They operate off the back of donations and some generous folk who want to support this kind of thing. And who knows, right? I mean, I think this probably, to some degree or another, is the future. I mean, predictably unpredictable winter seems like the norm. I mean, here we are. What's the date? It's March 23rd. It's 4 days into spring here in Vermont, and we are getting dumped with snow. Our biggest snowstorm of the year is now 4 days into spring because we didn't have a normal winter in traditional winter. So,
you know what I'll add?
Please.
Gravel could take some tips on their live video coverage. They did an excellent job.
Did they?
Oh, great commentary. Cameras capturing the elite front and mid pack, women and men, and then a constant finish line camera going the entire time. So I got to see Ted cross the line. I caught him at the start. And I've been recently just sort of frustrated with like trying to, I don't know about you, but I tried to watch Mid-South and, you know, not to be negative, but I know it's really challenging. But even if you're watching, I mean, the only way to really follow along was through Instagram stories. And they took the Instagram story for the men, for the elite men's win to the final corner, and then for 30 minutes left us hanging, and I was dying. Yeah. Because also there was no link that was, you know, no, there was a link, but it was not posted anywhere to the results. So someone eventually had to send it to me, but I feel like I'm pretty savvy. I searched the internet high and low and could not find that results link. And so that's a miss. I love Mid-South. I love Bobby. They got to get that link up on the results page. And every race director, you know, this is important.
The Luddite in me doesn't want to see live coverage. I would like to see results eventually, but I kind of... I still love, like, the cavalier nature.
It's
like,
the conduit to growing the sport. You got to be able to follow it.
But why do we need to grow the sport? Like, if somebody can't follow what the final sprint looked like, I don't care.
Well, if the only avenue that it's growing in currently is gravel, then the answer is yes, we need to grow the sport, if we care about the sport and the health of it that needs to grow.
I don't think that watching bike races on the internet is a mandatory tool in the growth of the sport.
Says the person who just wants to watch bike races.
I love and right. I love watching road races. Cycling
Weekly mailed to us in the U.S., but it would be like 6 weeks in the rears.
Uh huh.
And you were reading Cycling Weekly 6 weeks later after results. You know.
Okay, listener, we have an email for this reason. You tell us what you think. Do you care?
Yes.
Do you care about watching gravel coverage, and what are your thoughts and feelings on this?
That's a great one. And coming back to Berkey really quick, I hope another listener catches this. And Ted, I don't even know if you probably did see it. You're a detail guy. But you're doing your selfie video at Berkey, and you mm-hmm. were talking about the event, and right off camera over your right shoulder. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, totally. I love this. I nearly had to freeze frame it and put an arrow. I'd be like, TKO'd.
It, like big brother shoves down little sister, just like out of nowhere, pull cocks her and knocks her to the ground.
And because I am a detail person, you see them playing around a couple frames before. And so, it's almost like this wonderful foreshadowing that big brother has had enough and he just knocks her out.
He did. It was fantastic.
Yes. Good eye. All right. Good eye. You're not the only person.
Good job at Berkey. There were some other former World Tour pros at Berkey who I believe you beat. Can we create a little internet beef here with this? Or
we can create all the beef in the world, except I wouldn't be building myself up. Levi Leipheimer was there. I knew he was going to be there, but he beat me pretty handily. So
you guys skied together as I tracked you till about halfway?
That's probably about right. Yeah. I mean, I think the unfolding is very similar to that of a gravel race, right? I mean, we're mass start. The pros go away and do their thing. I had such an abysmal start because, I mean, no reason, like objectively, because I'm not a good skier. and so there's a point early on in the race where everybody is going by me and I start mid pack in a group of, I forget, 200 or 300, and just everybody sort of trickling by. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be DFL, which is not the worst thing in the world. That's totally fine. Somebody needs to do it. And so I got up to speed. I have my one speed, which is sort of diesel along. And then humming along, blah, 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 blah. And then I hear somebody chirping behind me, and it's Levi. And we're chatting away. And he's like this ninja outfit. He had like Spider-Man. He had this head cloth thing that just, he literally looked like, if you can picture Spider-Man. That sort of spandexy headpiece. I mean, I do not look in any way like I know what I'm doing. I look at him like, dang, this guy knows what he's doing.
Like an arrow hood?
Yeah, kind of. So we skied together for a while and had a good time. And I think what did surprise me is the Berkey does a terrific job of not letting people cut in line, as it were. And he had reached out to me being like, hey, I'm a pretty good skier. How do I get into the elite wave? And I'm like, I don't know. I earned my spot because I did this once before. And I literally have nobody I can ask for this position. He's like, okay, no problem. I saw him at the expo and then he still hadn't been upgraded. And the next thing I knew, there he was passing me in the Berkey. So props to Levi. He had a great ski. He was flying.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Move on to Valley of Tears.
From there.
To Mallorca. We talked about that last episode. And then you came back, went right to Valley of Tears.
Yeah, that was... I was not in my own tears making it to Amarillo and then on to Turkey, Texas. But typically, I'm pretty immune to the woes of travel. And I... Basically, punchline is I arrived to Texas... being awake for the better part of 30 hours, and this head cold that I'd been nursing for a couple days just hit me like a ton of bricks when I got to Texas. I wasn't in any position to complain because I was there voluntarily. I was excited to do this new race, and then I knew Laura had gone home to hang out with the kids, and I got this extra 3-day quasi bike race vacation. And I don't want to call it vacation because, I mean, bike racing is my job for all intents and purposes these days. And yeah, inaugural event, I don't know, well into the many hundreds of people taking place in Turkey, Texas, which I think, might be the smallest start town by population of any event that I've done literally ever, which says a lot because I've done some pretty remote races. And yeah, I mean, for whatever reason, it brought a hitter lineup. So Keegan went on to win the race, which he often does if he's on the start line. Brennan Wirtz, Alex Howes, Ryan Standish, Adam Roberge. There were plenty of super fast people who were there. It was great to pull the Band-Aid off, as it were, you know, to get my legs back under me to there's just a level of intensity that at least I can't push myself into while training. Which, I mean, objectively looks like higher power numbers than I've seen in years, or way higher average heart rate than I've seen in any bit of intense training lately. There's just nerves on the start line, which I'm kind of excited about. Like, I don't feel like I used to have nerves in a previous chapter. It's almost like we raced with such regularity in the World Tour that there wasn't time to be nervous. And now, on the opposite end, we're racing, what, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times a year. And, yeah, there's a lot at stake. So,
yeah, Ted's told me he's nervous twice, which is the last two races. Twice ever, the last two races that he's competed in.
That's telling.
I was kind of nervous at our wedding.
You were definitely nervous at our wedding, but yeah. I'm talking racing.
Yeah, that's...
Did you see him before, Cora, or did you just see the eyes as you walked down?
Oh, we did see each other before.
Okay. Yeah, I think I could... It's probably safe to say I was more nervous before our wedding. I mean, the slightly longer story is that, in general, I'm a pretty even-keeled person, and I can, like, be put on the spot and generally handle it just fine. I'd been in two of my best friends' weddings over the course of the previous whatever decade of my life, and both times I just had this, like, cosmic meltdown, kind of like what somebody who's supposedly in the wedding, like the bride or groom, is supposed to have when you see the like, all fails outtakes on whatever outtake video. And it's me up there, and I haven't passed out. It's not been that bad, but, like, just epic levels of sweating and nerves and angst and like, oh, man, it's so gnarly. So having done that for my two best friends' weddings, not the same two with whom we had our high school senior graduation party.
Callback.
Throwback, full circle. Yeah, I was like, shoot, what if this happens at my own wedding? Come on. And I don't foresee it coming. It's almost like everything's fine until it's a freak out moment. So.
And it's like self-perpetuating.
Yeah. So survived, and here we are 6 years later or so. Seven? How old? When? What?
Seven.
How old is your marriage?
I think.
We got married on the 18th day of the 17th year. Which we sometimes get confused whether it's the 17th day of the 18th year. Yeah, we got married in 2017.
Wow.
Bonus points for remembering that. Well, or just done, regular sir. Passing grade.
So what do you attribute the nervousness to at Valley of Tears? The newfound commitment and devotion to the training? Will this all have proven worth it? I mean, is it all that?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty sizable portion. I mean, I could do this all in a vacuum, and I could have told Laura and some close friends and just let it be and try to train my pants off. I didn't know what I was going to compare that to, but train down the house and then show up at races and slowly let the word out. They're like, oh, Ted's trying to be back. But having put myself out there, yeah, that raises a level of expectation. And it's been, I'd say, universally well-received. I'm flattered having gone to these two races so far and just really impressed with the outpouring of support and in-person messaging and, hey, Ted, I'm watching your videos and it's really cool to see you do this comeback. So, yeah, tremendously appreciated to those of you who have reached out and for anybody who is watching.
Well, and a part of your job is storytelling. So, you know, you're embracing it and you have a story. There is a story around this, and I think it's relatable. You know, and you are prepared for a variety of outcomes. And hopefully there are just good takeaways along the way, right? Like,
they're my fingers crossed.
Relatable to others as well, whether it's just changes in their lifestyle or diet and, you know, strength work or whatever it might be. Or just that, you know, 40 isn't the end. Like, you can still take control of the controllables and try to get faster amidst everything else that life is throwing at you. So I think that's the main takeaway, and that's something that people want to hear about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no disagreement. I've had the question posed to me, what is the measurement of success? What's the metric of success? And selfishly, yeah, I want to end up on a podium and I want to win races. And so doing the long yards and the hard work now hopefully will pay off so that I can be winning races. But it's not lost on me. I mean, the objective differences that I see in Mid-South, for example, from 5 years ago when I was second place in the final sprint for the win, as compared to a week ago, it's the racing is night and day. It is so different and so it's wild. I mean, it's just so much faster, so much harder, so much more competition showing up.
And what did you say? It was 45 minutes faster than the time.
Yeah, it was something
that you were competing for.
I think 35 minutes faster. I did it. Let me think. It was an average of like 30 watts more. Normalized was 40 watts more. There was a point that I was looking around and I'm like, gosh, any one of the 30 people in this group could legitimately win the race, as opposed to 5 years ago when there were three of us really duking it out for the final 40 miles.
Yeah, I think you said on one of your videos that you were over 300 watts normalized for Mid-South.
Yep. Over 300 average, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was 308 average and like 340 normalized. And I mean, yeah, I immediately came home and said something to that effect to Laura, and she's like, well, how does that compare to your world tour days? And it's like the racing was almost so much more scripted. So there's plenty of super hard days that were a bit chaotic in the world tour, but a race like the way gravel is raced, it's such like a kermesse. It's just nonstop attacking, where the attrition rate, I never know if it's at a high attrition rate when most people drop off.
Yeah.
Yes. So a relatively high attrition rate, but then that front group is so large that the attrition maybe is less so, or maybe it's greater, but the there are so many people who have the potential to do well. So yeah, in the world tour, there's so many moments that are relaxed and you can stop and pee and you can stop and literally watch your average power drop, whereas these gravel races don't have those moments. It's wild. It's a wild west.
And I was going to say, even from an anecdotal perspective, because like Laura, I'm watching on Instagram stories, right? And I'm, you know, cycling through to see the race develop. And it used to be, I mean, I know it's really anecdotal, but it used to be, you know, I could zig through the first, you know, 45 Instagram stories on that, because it's like, I want to get on with it. I want to, you know, I don't have all day. And now it's like there's these monstrous crashes and pileups all like in the first 6, 8, 10 miles, because guys are just killing each other for position into the first whatever bottleneck or the first pinch point. And that's got to indicate something about the speed, too. You guys aren't, like, rolling out anymore at a leisurely, you know, 200-watt pace for the first 30 minutes. And then, all right, well, let's race now. It's just insanity.
Yeah. I mean, it's typically a race to the first pinch point. So at Valley of Tears, it was a quarter mile into the race, we hit the first section of gravel, and then we knew that the sand was going to be very characteristic of the first, call it, dozen miles. And so deep, thick, soft, conveniently, really interesting sand. And that was the early separation. That was a very indicative separation. Mid-South, the first thing happened at mile 12. But as a result, yeah, it's basically just this full gas drag race. And so conveniently, I didn't see any crashes then, but yeah, to your point, it's really dynamic, fast-paced racing.
11th at Valley of Tears.
That sounds right.
Is pretty stinking impressive given the murderer's row of pros that were there. 14th at Mid-South. Is that correct?
I think that's right. Yeah, I was talking
maybe
to the...
most importantly, first place dad.
Well, you know...
Well, 12th, 13th, 14th all rolled over the line. Didn't you roll over
this
the
line? This is true. Three of us rolled over the line together. Joe from the UK, Payson, myself. And so we were kind of duking it out for 12th, but we'd basically given up the ghost. And so on the opposite end of the hyper-competitive spectrum, the three of us literally, we tried to cross the line at the same time.
Make it tough on
exactly.
The scores.
4 minutes under the winning time, which that's just amazing to me that you now have 12th, 13th, 14th place, just 4 minutes off the win.
Yeah.
Well, it was funny also talking to Bobby afterwards. So you stop and Bobby naturally is going to hug every single participant. And so I'd cross the line. We're chatting a few minutes later. And he said, right now, you're still, if you'd cross the line right now, you would still have the record setting pace. And last year was fast. And the year before was fast. And the year before was fast. What I really want to point out is not first place dad, because that pesky Pete is very fast, and he's the father of twins, and hats off to Pete Stetna, who finished.
Did he sneak it? He snuck in ahead of you?
Yeah, he was.
Well, I didn't see that.
Total front group.
He was sixth?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay. It was sixth coming in, and he tried an early sprint that didn't work.
How'd you know that? I thought you couldn't see the final.
Oh, that's what I saw. He tried to get away early, and then
you just had bated breath? You're like, what?
It was very frustrating.
What happened?
Actually, they never showed the end. Like, they eventually posted the winner, but they never showed the finish, so.
Oh my gosh, how'd you sleep that night?
Nobody likes a bully, Ted.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
A bully?
You know what's going to happen, Laura, is now you're going to get offered, like, your 14th job, because they're going to offer for you to head up the media
conference. Yeah, you think you can do it better?
Yes, I do.
Well, we'll pay you many ones of dollars.
Tell us about your grasshopper. We want to hear about your race.
Oh, you know what? I was really hoping we could just skip over it. I had a really weird moment, guys. So grasshopper, for those who don't know, there's only two courses at grasshopper. There's a short course that I think is like largely completely different. I'm not super familiar with it. And then a long course. I did the long course. Last year, they cut off the long course because there was so much snow. So you came over kind of the second big climb of the day. You descended to a T in the road, and you're supposed to go right. But last year, they only let the front group of pros go right. Everybody else, they forced left and said, sorry, that it's snowing over the pass. And the guys, I guess the guy who won supposedly ran with his bike for like 10K over the climb. Now, I don't know if that's actually true, because I think that last climb is actually not even quite 6 miles, but the rumor went that he had been some standout D1 cross-country runner, and he just picked up his bike and ran with it. So,
what was the name of this hopper again?
This is Huffmaster.
This was the one out of Maxwell.
Huffmaster?
Yeah, Huffmaster. Okay. Exactly. So anyway, I came to the tee in the road, and guys, I don't know what, I was tired, but I don't know what happened. I had like this momentary lapse of toughness, focus, devotion, commitment. So I just got soft in the moment. And I remembered from the year prior, if you go left, it's just, you basically ride 20 miles in on road and you're done. And it's like, you know, largely flat. And I just, I don't know, like my brain just switched off and I just went left and I didn't go right and finish. And so I rolled in and I got like 3 or 4 miles into that, and just all the thoughts in your head, like, what are you doing? Why did you do that? Why didn't you finish the race, you goofball? You're only going to knock off, you start doing the mental math in your head and realized I'm only going to knock off like 6 miles going this way. Now I am going to knock out a climb. But anyway, the punchline, the short version, is I totally wussed out and I took the left turn and, you know, cut the course, finished early. Got to the finish line, told them at the finish line, hey, mark my number down, because I took the left and took the short version. I said, great, got your number. And then this is the saddest part, and I don't even remember the guy's name, but in the 45 plus category, they did not take down my number correctly. And so I start getting all these text messages and Instagram messages from people later that day. So,
Congratulations.
Dude, you won the 45 and over. There were like some legit guys there. And I go, no, I dropped out and wrote the short version back. And so to whoever actually won, I forget who it was. Kudos to you. So that was my grasshopper. It was a great day. I had a really good ride, but I just do not know what happened. And I guess better that it happened for the first event of the season for me versus later in the year when things might matter more to me. But gosh, I've been kicking myself ever since. It's been a month.
And that's going to be your motivation next time. I mean, there's not a bike racer who hasn't had a day. You know, we all have those days, and that was yours. So
I guess.
When you say you said you've been kicking yourself for a month for it, how much have you taken away? Meaning, have you found a reason for it, or have you found peace with it, or do you continue to kick yourself about it? Like, where's your mental state now?
No, but I have used it as fuel. I think Laura nailed it. Like, it's been fuel for me. Like, we talked on the last episode about my ride in Orlando where I just needed to get over the 100-mile mark. Mm-hmm. And I did this 100-mile ride. And at mile 60, I was really tired and thought, I'm going to look for a shortcut and just cut this thing short. And a shortcut didn't pop up real easily on my mapping app. And then I just thought about Grasshopper. I'm like, what are you doing? You're doing it twice now. You're trying to cut it short again. So that day I finished my 100 miles. Yesterday I did a really long day and was the first ride of the year where I actually tacked on 10 miles at the end because I was feeling really good.
Nice.
And I finally got my nutrition right. And I thought, I've been cutting things short. I cut Grasshopper short. I'm going to add 10 today. So instead of doing 70 miles yesterday, I ended up doing 82. And fairly hard for me, almost 6,000 feet of climbing. So it was a big day for me.
Good for you.
Yeah, I was really pleased. So it's coming around. So I think it's been fuel. I'm not like losing sleep over it, but I do feel, I'm going to have to talk about that with Ted and Laura. And they're like doing 40-hour weeks in Mallorca riding 600 miles, and I can't finish 80. So anyway. Hopefully next week when I ride my long all night ride.
That's coming up.
Good news.
That's coming up in a big way.
Yeah. 10 days.
How do you feel about that?
I'm really nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like legitimately nervous. I was in my garage today trying to figure out my lighting situation. I think I have it figured out, but I don't have I don't have like a powered hub or anything like that. I'm just using, your mm-hmm. USB plug-in, bike lights. So, you're trying to figure out the math of, okay, it takes five and a half hours to charge this light. And on low power, it will last 5. So if all things are equal, I can charge. Okay, so I'm going to need 3 lights to get me through so I can have 1 charge, all that. So I think I've got that math figured out. But I am finding myself obsessing over some of those details more than I ordinarily would. So
that is certainly part of it, obsessing over those details. Because then you're like, is that an actual 5 hours burn time? Or is that a theoretical 5 hours? Right. And you don't want to end up on 0 hours. So, yeah, what's the overlap you're comfortable with? And what is the temperature that night? Because that burns batteries differently. Yeah, I think it's awesome. I think doing the ride is going to give you tremendous peace, and it's not until you've started that peace will settle in. And then in hindsight, you're going to have learned a ton and be ready for the next one.
Yeah, and hopefully come out of it with some good fitness for Levi's Grand Fondo.
Mm-hmm.
Which really...
I'm laughing because you pronounce it like a running gym. Fondo.
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 That's
Fondo.
Right. Fondo.
You can say it any which way you want. I think anybody who says Fondo will elicit a response, much like you have.
Yes. It's just my excitement to be with you guys, and Laura's kicking off her race season. How are you feeling about it, Laura?
I don't know. If you're not racing till April, are you really even racing? It feels that way sometimes. Feels like I'm off the back or something, but I'm grateful for a little extra time because I'm also feeling a little off the back with my preparedness. And enter Coach Ted King over here, who I recently requested a training schedule from. I do this fairly often, I request a training schedule from him when I'm kind of in the final weeks of gearing up for races that I maybe care about. Most of them, I guess, but or just want some fine tuning. I think I have a general, from being coached many years in the past, I have a good general sense of just the foundational workouts that I need to do to start to build fitness. But then when it comes to starting to fine tune, it's really helpful to have someone tell you what to do. And it also is some good accountability. And just has realizing too, is just helping me plan. So Ted gave me a training schedule for the next few weeks. I've done 2 so far of my workouts. I mean, this is the first winter that we've been in Vermont and had to kind of, just do what we can with the weather here. Last year we spent the lead up in Northern California in Healdsburg to our racing. And so we're doing a ton of riding and I felt pretty fit at that point. So I'm looking forward to Levi's. I'm looking forward to Sea Otter. But as I recall from my Sea Otter XL Fuego experience, that is a really long and hard mountain bike race early season. So it's hard to go into that confident when you're coming from Vermont winter. That said, it's fine. I'm going to just, have the mindset that I'm doing everything I can. It'll be what it'll be. And I know I'm not in terrible shape. I'm just, things could be a little bit sharper. So we'll see how that goes. But I am kicking off my Northern California trip. I'm leaving a little early. Ted's going to hang out with the kids. And I am going to the Bay Area with my friend and former pro roadie, Sarah Headley. It's a little bit of a mom's weekend. We're going to go do some training on bikes together. And then Ted and the kids will join us, or we'll join up, 4 or 5 days later after I get some riding in. So I'm looking forward to that to kind of kick things off. And it's always fun to be in Northern California meeting up with our friends and community there.
Are you gonna do the Mount Tam climb? I've seen you do that with the ladies groups a few times.
We sure are. We're gonna do Dawn Patrol, which it's awesome. So we're flying in on a Thursday. Sarah Headley, it's her birthday on Friday, so she requested that we do a Dawn Patrol. So we'll fly in. I guess East Coast time will help us because Dawn Patrol is the whole point of that is. We start in Mill Valley and make it to the top of Mount Tam by sunrise. Watch the sunrise. Our good friend Jeff Junkston is kind of the mayor of Dawn Patrol there and has helped kind of make it a thing. You can follow his amazing videos and photographs on Instagram. And he's does a great job of just sort of like, creating stoke over this Dawn Patrol thing. So a lot of people head up to the summit before work and get in this early lap. And if you've never been to the top of Mount Tam, it's one of the most stunning sunrises. There's often that like lower level of fog and it's kind of a often ethereal kind of experience up there. And so, looking forward to that for sure.
Oh, that's awesome. I've never done Mount Tam either. And I'm a NorCal guy.
What?
I know. Isn't that ridiculous? So I'm going to be living vicariously through you and very jealous of
you. You got to get down there.
I've seen you do it before when I think it was like a wedding weekend or something when you guys were
Yeah, anytime we have a reason for a celebration, it calls for a dawn patrol. So my best friend Emily got married, and her husband Chris Shearholt is a big Mount Tam. They're both big fans of Mount Tam, and got married at the base of Mount Tam. So it called for a dawn patrol.
That's so cool.
There's not just one nice way to ride up Mount Tam. There are a whole host of amazing rides up Mount Tam. So you have to go and just really. Well, take a few days and go ride Mount Tam from every side. It's just spectacular.
So cool. And then in the midst of that, then Ted will come out with the kids for Levi's. You guys are both doing the big monster course. That's correct?
The Panzer, I think they call it.
I meant to mention this to you. I don't know that you've actually looked at the new course, but it says we go over geysers.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, this is a fun surprise.
So Ted,
and then you add like a little extra loot to it.
It's a burly one.
It's brutal.
I'll look at the course someday. Well, yeah, somebody not too long ago, it was Derek. He's like, do you think you guys will be finished at 1? I'm like, I don't know what time we start. I don't know the course. I don't know the distance. I don't know our average speed. So, of course, I don't know what time we're going to finish.
Yeah, it's an all new course.
Well, yeah, it's a mini mega hopper, which is to say, the Grasshoppers, the event that Stu was talking about doing, are these iconic Northern California, just north of San Francisco, Marin, Napa Valley, Sonoma County, most notably, rides. And then the Mega Hopper was linking together all of the courses that they've ever done. And then this is effectively a mini one of those. So,
you know, which
should be a bruiser.
Yeah, which brings to mind Amity, a well-known gravel racer and friend of mine messaged me recently, we were talking about how excited we are about this road course, and she said something to the effect of, if road racing courses were like this, I would have stuck with road racing. And that resonated with me too, because my first kind of foray into road racing, I was just kind of underwhelmed by A, the courses and where they're held, and then B, the distance and the difficulty. And right around that time, I tried my first Grasshopper, which I believe was maybe Chileno Valley. They don't hold that one anymore, but it was a road, all road hopper, and it's, you know, I don't know, 8,000 feet of climbing and 100 miles. I don't know the exact stats, but I did that. Yeah, I did that ride, and I thought, now this is what I wish women's road racing was like. And it wasn't just that. I loved the mass start. I loved just the overall general feel. It's so interesting because it's before gravel was even a thing, right? But that was when I was comparing road racing, and I had a very kind of just not a warm experience. The women were not very friendly. It was very intimidating. And I had a complete opposite experience going to the Grasshopper. So for me, it was an easy decision. This is the kind of racing I want to do. It's long, hard. You get to be with the men and the women. And I just had, you know, it feels friendly and it feels fun. And it's just spectacular views and like world-class riding. So slightly a tangent, but I just think that we don't get a lot of opportunities to do a road race of this kind of caliber, at least on the women's side.
Yeah, that's a ridiculous course.
You're looking at it now.
Yeah, yeah. King Ridge, Skaggs, Lake Sonoma Hopper, out to Geysers. So
what's the total elevation then?
1 million, actually.
Yeah, it's huge.
13.5.
138 miles, 113,000 feet of climbing. That's proper. Anyway.
Yeah, after we spoke recently and I went to register for the event, I was looking at the courses, and it was very easy for an aging age grouper like me to say, well, I'm not doing that one. I'll drop down. So I'll do the geysers, whatever that.
Well, sheesh. I was just talking about Sea Otter being long and hard. I guess I misspoke because Levi's will be.
It is funny because, the Grand Fondo is 120 miles and still ridiculously hard. So this just throws on a super duper hard bonus.
Yeah.
It'll be great.
Yeah, you're going to have a good time.
Fun times.
Well, linking those two things that Laura was talking about what the foray towards gravel, because road racing for her and obviously for lots of others didn't hold attention and was difficult. There was this article that came out recently and we swapped it back and forth about the sort of F1-ification of gravel racing, you know, and they centered in on this idea of these like F1 style pit stops. I think it was at Unbound where they were filming Sophia and watching her come in and this pit crew of four people and all the changes and got knee high socks people are wearing now. And I mean, what's your take on that, guys? I mean, you guys are in the midst of this pro gravel evolution and you guys have been quick to adopt some of the changes and also hesitant to adopt others, or at least just haven't adopted them. What's your take on all this evolution?
I feel like there's an inevitability to it with the professionalization, with the need for speed, with the focus on results, that it brings in more resources. Or success requires more resources. Or I shouldn't even say that. Success is benefited by more resources. And by that, I mean somebody like, and I'm not in any way calling out Sophia, because plenty of people are doing it, to have a pit crew is tremendously helpful so that you can be in and out and save yourself, whatever, 10, 30, 40, 60, 90 seconds. And I mean, I've benefited from that myself. I've had one mechanic, and he's wonderful, and I continue to plan to use him. But there, I remember my first time I ever did Unbound, rolling into the first aid station and thinking the same thing, being like, oh my gosh, what on earth? Why are we in and out of here so quickly? I thought this was going to be like an easy 2-minute stop. It was a very intense 30-second stop. You bring up the calf guards, the aero sock thing. Like, there's something very funny about those. But in the age in which we live, someone was telling me that the gains that you get from aerodynamic socks and shoe covers diminish what you're seeing in waxing your chain and everything related to drivetrain. And I feel like that's like hyper nerdy right now is all the drivetrain talk. So forget that. Why don't you focus on the macro at this point, which is aero socks? Like I said when I was talking about the Luddite in me, like, yeah, I would like to go back to a time that those things are not important. But until you institute a rule, which they certainly could at this point, no different than, you know, barring aero bars or something like that, there could be some kind of rule that says no pit stops, no outside support. You are going to support yourself. Unfortunately, with every rule, it seems to invite not a counter rule, but something like what we saw at SB2 2 or 3 years ago, where people are going to go in with all of the equipment and resources necessary so that they don't even need to stop. And that begins to put people at risk, I think, because if you're going in with the expectation to stop and then you see people riding away, you're like, oh shoot, I'm going to skip that aid station and then continue racing, only to realize 10 miles later that you're hyper dehydrated and it's 95 degrees in the Kansas hot and humid heat.
You know, maybe. I guess I think about like Ironman and professional triathlon. And Anna Marie, who wrote that cycling news article, her suggestion or solution to the problem was drop bags. And that's exactly what Ironman protocol is. So they have neutral aid stations where you can stop. They do often have, you can stay on the bike and grab a water bottle from an aid station volunteer. But you can also choose to grab your drop bag or you can choose not to. And I mean, that hasn't happened in triathlon. I think, you know, they say often nutrition is the fourth discipline of triathlon because it is so crucial and so important. And I think at the end of the day, if you continue to push the limits, you are going to pay the price. So, I mean, I think it's a better solution to kind of equalize the field a little bit where they can. I'd be for that.
Laura, what's your take on the different start times for men and women?
Ooh, my perspective on this one has changed. And that is because, well, I love the dynamic of the mass start, and I've always loved racing with the men, and it just, yeah, I've always thought it's fun to be out there with everyone. However, especially after becoming a mom, I'm terrified now in mass starts, and I describe myself as a pretty technically savvy rider who's confident, and I've struggled a lot recently. Even in, you know, I raced Unbound 100 last summer, and even that start, it was a mass start, it wasn't separated, felt harrowing, and all I wanted was there to be a split at some point. And 10 miles in, there's just nowhere, you know, there's no major climb. And that's actually something. So if it's a course where there's no opportunity for separation, which I do appreciate a lot of the races that, you know, put a really big climb right in the beginning, because I think that is honestly the safest way to go. If there's no opportunity for that, then I think the next best option is separating the field. And that is that a bummer to me? Yes, it is a bummer. But it's also a relief at the same time, because I'd rather be safe.
Yeah, I can see how that would be. One of the things I would say, like from an age grouper perspective, in all the separation of the categories and all of that, one of the things that hasn't been lost yet in gravel, in my experience, at least at the grassroots events, is that sort of interaction with the pros. And I think for us age groupers, not like in a hounding, annoying, stalkery kind of way, which I'm sure you guys have had those experiences, and those are, I'm sure, awful and not fun. I mean, like the really wholesome, like Ted and Laura King are parked next to you in their rental car, and you're all in the same parking lot, and there's no VIP tent, and you guys are, you know, saying hey to random age groupers. That part of gravel, like even at the last Grasshopper, you had all these pro guys. You know, Pete is there with his big Canyon van and, you know, all his crazy paint and all that stuff. And, but he's parked in the same parking lot, and he's friendly with people, and he's hanging out. And that part of gravel, I'm so glad, hasn't gone the way of the dodo bird. Do you guys anticipate that remaining that way? Or do you think the professionalization, we're going to start seeing the, you know, velvet ropes enclose the pros vans and all that stuff?
I think the latter.
Yeah.
I think they're going away. I think you see teams, Specialized does it, the Specialized off-road team, and you show up and you have a whole suite of staff. And yeah, I mean, yeah, I get a kick out of, take Valley of Tears, for example. You know, I fly in looking after myself, and all the other pros were also, and hats off to them. And so, yeah, I mean, like, I remember being in the parking lot asking somebody for a pump, and they got a kick out of giving me a pump, and I was thrilled to have used it, and I was appreciative, and we got a picture, and it was fun.
You get quite a few comments on your Strava or on Instagram, just like thanking you for your time, and people that are excited to have met you and interact with you. I think that is a huge component to, like, the you know, what gravel has. It's still special.
I think it is special. I think the athletes appreciate it on both sides of the equation. I just think there's something about the professionalism. I mean, I think the inevitability here is also teams. And so whether it is a team of six or a team of two, teams will beget that, I'm going to make up a word, corindization, like where you're being corned off, cordoned off. Mm-hmm. What's the word here? And being able to relax, put your legs up and not think about your bike and just sit in the shade for a while we take care of your equipment. And you know, maybe we get to the point that the athlete won't even know what they're missing, because I do think that I agree with you wholeheartedly, Steve. I think that's a fun part of it all. And, you know, gravel still has a lot of great aspects. So whether or not that exists, hopefully there's the post-race party and amalgamation of everybody where, you know, you can share that, the conversation and the shared experience of, oh, yeah, I remember at mile 20, so-and-so happened and this happened and this. I don't know. I still think those things will continue. Unless, I mean, and then thinking down the road, maybe the calendar gets so busy that, no, there's not enough time after the race so that the pro has to get on the plane to fly off to the next race. Then we're basically just back to World Tour road racing. I don't know. It's a great thought experiment. I guess we'll wait and see.
Yeah. It seems a good time as any to go to some listener questions.
I dig it. What do you got for us?
Who wants to take them? You want me to start with Mike W?
Hit it, Mike.
Mike W writes, as the sport grows with the Lifetime Grand Prix and the subsequent show, and more pros moving to gravel, one aspect of the spirit of gravel, he does in quotes, that seems to be falling by the wayside is the experience for amateurs. With the team you've assembled, it seems like you have a potential to tap into that perspective about what's relevant and relatable to the everyday cyclist. His question, how should a new cyclist approach searching for and choosing the right first event to sign up for?
I feel like I've started, been the first to respond to questions. So I defer to the other two hosts of this show for right now.
That's a tough one. I mean, before even thinking, I guess, about, I mean, there's a few categories he's interested in here. It's the experience for amateurs, but also just the right first event. So I guess first and foremost, I would think about where your skill set lies and not necessarily just like, I mean, where, not necessarily where you see all the hoopla. Because first and foremost, why not find an event that suits your skill set and strengths? Because that's going to hopefully result in the best, you know, personal experience and satisfaction for you. That's actually, I mean, for the most part, I try to apply that to my own event calendar and looking for events that I'm, you know, for me personally, I like more twists, turns, technical sections, and cooler temperatures. So those are the aspects I'm attracted to. So I mean, there are databases of events certainly that you can look up, but I think really just if you're able to interface and interact with other cyclists and get their take, you're going to learn what's local, what's, you know, the people who have gone to the events, what they have to say, and that's probably where you're going to get the most honest and best feedback. But I don't know, what do you think about, Stu, about the aspect of the experience for amateurs?
Yeah, I think the experience for the amateur will largely be based on, one, how well the organization of the race is. Is it ran well? Is it professional? Is it, and I don't mean professional in the terms of professionalization of the sport, but like, is just it a well-run event? Are people enthusiastic? And I think you said it well, you said the word local. And I think I would just say, find something local for your first event.
Yeah.
Go somewhere that, you know, it's really easy to go on Instagram and see a new event every single weekend, which is lovely and awesome. I'm so glad that there's new events popping up. But there's very few people who can afford to get on an airplane and box up a bike and fly to another state and rent a hotel, you know, all the stuff that goes with it. So I think the best amateur experience for me, the best age group experience I have, is when I can wake up in my own bed on a Saturday. It may be 4 a.m., but I can wake up in my own bed that morning, you know, throw the ice chest in the car and go drive to an event, do the event, and drive home and be home for dinner with my family. Like, that's a big win. And that will also go a long way in making sure I can do other events. So I think find something really local and make friends. Get to know people.
Yeah, couldn't agree
more. Do the
more.
Shakeout ride, you know?
Mm-hmm.
hang out for the barbecue afterwards, even if you don't want to, and just get to know people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ted, what do you think, man? Picking your first event.
Yeah, I would. The first thing I would lean into is local. I think the convenience factor there is just impossible to beat. And then almost with the local event, you don't have the professionalization. Which I'm not trying to call out any small event, but you know, there are so many events popping up right now that if you get a post race beer and burrito, you feel like you're already winning, and like that yeah. that's a huge thing. And so from there, like if that is your benchmark, then every other experience presumably is going to be that much bigger. If there's a post race band, if there's post race activations, if there's an expo, all those things. Yeah, I mean, almost counter to what they're saying, and I'm sort of the first person to call out Lifetime because I don't want to see a monopolization. I think Lifetime does a good job of creating a festival. I mean, I'm trying to think of the events that they do, right? Sea Otter, that is a festival unto itself. That's just a bananas event. Unbound, that is a really cool, like the community is what you are there for at Unbound. I've never done Schwamigan. I can't speak to that. Big Sugar is a huge festival, and if you're a cyclist and haven't been to Bentonville, I think that's a great reason to go. Crusher and the Tusher, admittedly, that one does cater to a experienced cyclist. I'm good friends with Burke Swindlehurst. We're former teammates from, almost 20 years ago. Because their course is so challenging at altitude in Utah, and it's just a ridiculously hard course that, yeah, there's not going to be a lot of first-timers who are going to show up to an event that challenging.
Leadville's kind of like that, too.
Well, shoot, I was going to say, yeah, Leadville, like, okay, you're either going to do well or get your doors blown off. And the majority of people who are not named Keegan are get their doors blown off. And you're like, you're there for the festival. You're there for the experience. So, I don't know. There are a lot of experiences to be had in that huge spectrum, from beer and burrito, local race, to a 3,000 person Lifetime event. So what's cool is just start dropping in on them as best you can and choose. There are so many different experiences. Choose which one you like. Do you like the big? Do you like the small? Do you like the hyper competitive? Do you like the non-competitive? There's a lot out there.
Yeah, I think that's a good word. The hyper-competitive, the non-competitive. And, you know, a lot of the events are still not timed.
Yeah.
And they may have segment timers, mm-hmm. but the whole event itself is not timed. And then other events, you know, you're getting a chip and you're timed. So I think that that's another important consideration for people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Kim Kardashian. We have a listener question from Kim Kardashian. It's not really Kim. It's Katie.
From close nearby, Woodstock, Vermont.
Yeah, it seems reasonable that you guys should have to read this one and answer it, since yeah. it's like your neck of the woods.
I got it.
I don't know this event.
Rasputitsa, we are familiar. Katie says, I'm looking forward to riding / racing the Rasputitsa this year. I have not raced bikes for 25 years, and I feel quite out of touch with the whole gravel scene. I'm super excited. I want to pull together the ideal kit and gravel bike setup for the event. Might you have some useful tips for this event? I'm also quite familiar with fueling for long running events, but would love some fueling tips for gravel race day. So let's start out with, okay, she wants to pull together the ideal kit and gravel bike setup. Ted, do you want to speak to that?
Certainly. So Rasputitsa is, my understanding is, it is the Russian term for mud season. And depending on the year here in Vermont, it's usually it is always an early season event. It can be a quagmire of mud, and that's sort of what they're celebrating. I've also done it in dry years, so you never know what you're going to get, and that's just basically spring in New England. So I think with about 95% assurance, I would go into that event with 40 to 44 mil wide knobby tires. It is largely a standard gravel road race, and then you'll drop into a section that they will call Siberia, which is going to be class 4. It can be muddy, it can be snowy, it can be a running section. It's going to be a little bit crazy. But yeah, for sure, 100%, without a doubt, do it on a gravel bike. A gravel bike, or you can pull it off on a mountain bike if it's your first event in 25 years. Bring warm clothes. They've also had some crazy snowy years. So look at the forecast. If it's going to snow, bring your booties, bring your mittens, bring your hand warmers, bring the whole kit and caboodle.
No, and
that's what I would say for kit and gravel bike.
That's perfect. And so, Katie, you're already familiar with fueling for long running events, but you love fueling tips for gravel race day. I would say practice accessing your fuel. That's going to be your biggest challenge for an event like this. You're probably going to have some bulky gloves on, and bulky gloves make everything harder for accessing your nutrition, even when it's just in your back pocket. So this might be the time to pull out like some kind of bento box to put on your top tube that's just really easy to access, but maybe open the packages of your sports nutrition beforehand and have them, you know, ready so that you can just kind of pull out your food from your pocket, however you might store it, just have it easily accessible. And I think about what you choose to consume. This might be a time to put a lot of calories in your drink bottles because it's, again, it's just the easiest access and you're getting your hydration at the same time. Maybe you just want to put a gel of some kind. We prefer maple syrup in a flask, and then you're not messing with packages. You can put up to like 5 gels in a flask. And lately that's been our kind of go-to, is just being able to get the most calories into that flask and not have to deal with tearing off all these tabs and messing with the package after the fact.
And there was a specific question: might you have any useful tips for this event? So I don't know how deep into the weeds I'm diving here. I think knowing your course is helpful. And if you know you're getting into your Aspetitsa, for example, know that it's a short-ish but challenging course. So it's not one of these middle America 200-mile flat races. It is a very punchy, rolly trip through northern Vermont. So, I mean, at this point, it's a little bit 11th hour to be doing all of your training, because I think the race is just a week or three away. But yeah, practice the high intensity stuff. Work on, you know, sprinting up hills. Work on your bike dexterity. Know that, you know, this could be a race that is going to be ripping down hills. And on the topic of nutrition, Rasputitsa is definitely the kind of event that I think celebrates a feed zone. And if you are gunning it at the front of the pack, like we were talking about a handful of minutes ago, then maybe you're going to be ripping through a feed zone. But stopping is great. Stopping is a great way to perpetuate the happiness in the gravel community. So stop, pick up your... In fact, maple syrup at Rasputitsa at one of the feed zones was one of the first times that I had maple syrup on a bike ride. And lo and behold, now I have a maple syrup sports nutrition company. So yeah, stop, enjoy the scene, eat some food, ride hard, dress warm, have a blast. Rasputitsa.
That's a great point. I mean, if you are not the, you know, hardcore, have to get my best time PR person, I would absolutely embrace those stops because they're going to be a whole lot of fun, and you're probably going to end up making some friends along the way.
Yeah, it's awesome. That's one of the things that I didn't factor in when entering gravel, and you guys alluded to it really well, is the dexterity of nutrition. Mm-hmm. Like, I was a road cyclist for a long time. I'm comfortable on a bike. My handling skills are confident. And then I started riding gravel, and it's fine because you would stop and eat a snack while you were out for a long gravel ride. That was part of the beauty and fun of riding a gravel bike. And then you get into your first race, and it's like, you know, doing a 4.5-hour criterium. Mm-hmm. And just the idea of trying to, as you mentioned it, Laura, trying to even unwrap the packaging on a bar and get that in your mouth while you're bouncing around, rattling the teeth out of your head. And then the bar breaks in half and goes in the dirt. It's so key to have that nutrition handy. I love your tip of the little bento box.
This could be a great call out to the audience. If you have questions about nutrition, I guarantee we could talk an entire episode and a half about nutrition. And we have many tens of thousands of miles of experience. I completely agree with you, Stu. Practicing your nutrition.
Fueling early and often, you know, not waiting till you're hungry or thirsty, being on top of it, having a plan. practicing that plan in your workouts. I mean, these are all things that I've worked in sports nutrition half my career, and I still this year have made a more conscious effort to employ these tips for myself, right? Like both Ted and I have been focusing on getting more calories in earlier and every hour than we have in the past. And, you know, science is also showing us now that we're capable, our bodies are capable of processing more carbohydrates than we thought possible, and that your gut is trainable. So the importance cannot be understated of practicing your nutrition in training, because you are, think about it, you are really training your gut to better absorb that carbohydrate.
That's so helpful to me. Thanks, guys. Ted, you want Brian Chapman or shall I?
I like to read. Man, I'm doing the thing that I did last time where I'm late in the conversation. My voice is going.
I was going to say, I thought you were over your
all right.
Sickness.
What do you each consider to be the most valuable workout that helps your riding, one, in the off season, and two, during the riding season? That is a wonderful question. Stu, favorite off-season workout, favorite in-season workout?
Man. Well, here's the beauty of being an age grouper. My off-season workouts can be sparse, and I don't have to. You guys are some of the most consistent people I've ever seen in my entire life, and, like, just incredibly so. But I would say, for me, like, split squat lunges with a little dumbbell in my hand up and down my driveway is amazing. And when I'm on Zoom calls all day for work, I literally can go out in a 10-minute break and I can do a set down the driveway and a set back up the driveway, and I can do 5 sets of those in a day. And those are great for strength training for me, at least, that, you know, dipping lunge. So that's really helpful in the off season. I don't really do it in season at all. In season for me, and Ted alluded to the long ride, even as I'm aging, I'm finding the one long ride a week changes everything. So for me, it's anything at the 4-hour mark or over. Mm-hmm. And I pretty rarely do more than 4 hours, but something happens, at least in my body, at 4 hours. Zone 2, zone 3, easy day. And some of that, to Laura's point, is forcing me to train my gut, even if I don't want to, because I'm having to eat for 4.5 hours. But just a long, steady day. So, yeah, for me, those are the two, off-season, in-season, that are the big keys.
Laura?
Gosh. I don't know if this would be the most valuable workout, but something that is valuable to me in the off-season is just integrating sprints. And the reason for that into my endurance riding, right? So today, Coach Ted over here gave me an hour and a half ride and said, do 8 15-second sprints throughout the workout. And I think it's easy, especially if you don't have a coach or a program, to ride in the same zone all the time. And so it's really nice to get the feeling and dichotomy of what it feels like to go really hard and what it feels like after that 15-second sprint, trying to just go back to holding your endurance pace and not letting your power, like, completely fall off. And just getting your legs, keeping a little bit of that feeling of speed in your legs. So that's been helpful for me. And during the riding season, first and foremost, riding with people faster than me, and I prefer to do that. I love a good, fast, hard group ride. And I also love being able to stay on Ted's wheel. It's a fun challenge. Sometimes to me, it feels like its own race, and it feels like I win the race when I don't get dropped. I just find the carrot really motivating. So I think sometimes you'll go harder than you ever think you can or is possible when you're chasing someone.
I think staying diversified off season is invaluable. I picked up strength training for the first time in a decade or more this year. And I think that's great for, I don't want to say the aging athlete, but I mean, you know, strength training is great for people of all ages, and it's only that much more beneficial the older you get. However, I actually think running is my favorite off-season activity, and almost for the same reasons. It's like, it's as high intensity as you want. It is great for bone health. It is great for the really quick workout, especially in the off-season when it's cold and you don't have as much time that you can dedicate to it. And much like strength training, the more you do it, it just perpetuates, and you don't feel like you're crippled when you go for that first 5 mile run. In season, I had seen this question and I was like, I'm not going to give a specific workout. I'm going to say something to the effect of make sure you're diversified and do a little of this, a little VO2s, a little threshold, a little tempo. However, I want to say I was teammates with Tor Hushoft, and I think it was he who my first rookie NeoPro year in Europe, he's like, form finders. He was talking about 40-20s and just the value of that kind of intensity, 40 seconds on, 20 seconds off, usually eight efforts per set, 2, 3, 4 sets, depending on how deep into the season you are. It's like, I just love the way you described it. Form finders. You want to find form real quick, go smash yourself with a handful of those intervals.
Is that an all out 40 seconds, whatever you can sustain for 40?
Or yeah. I mean, the way I try to prescribe it, as the highest you can sustain. So I don't want to see 1,000 watts that drops down to 350 by the end. So try to plateau it. Inevitably you're going to be really hard in the beginning and settle in. So yeah, go hard and then settle in, but really try hard to, your final 5 seconds are going to be awful. And then those 20 seconds are going to go foolishly quickly. 30-30s are a good compromise. You know, a shorter on effort and a longer off effort, but 40-20 is a proper kick to the teeth.
That's awesome. A form finder.
Form finders. I just remember his accent. The form finder. That was a terrible Norwegian accent.
Do it more. It makes up for Levi's Grand Fondue.
Remember Jim saying that? Fondue?
Marathon?
Yeah.
We're just excited. Which is the next time we'll see each other.
Brilliant.
Listeners, I think we're going to record an episode together.
That's right.
In the area is the word on the street. So
2.5 weeks.
It's going to be a good time.
Again, rather than saying this in an intro or outro, folks, send your questions in to gravelkingspodcast@gmail.com. We're official because we have a Gmail email address. We haven't yet gotten the real website. No, send your questions in. We're excited to answer them. They can be about anything. They can be about nutrition. If we want to have a whole episode on that, that might bore you or that might keep you wrapped awake. Whatever you got, we're excited for it. And we're excited to see you, Stu, in a handful of weeks. What is that? 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Roughly?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, the Grand Fondue is early April. I want to say like 13th-ish.
12th, I think.
That's what I said.
No, 13th
something
is
like
right.
That.
Yeah, 13th.
Rarely wrong.
I thought I was wrong once. Turns out I was mistaken.
That's a t-shirt waiting to happen.
Yeah. It's been fun, guys.
Thanks.
It's been great. I wish you a wonderful evening. Happy Saturday. Happy weekend. Happy end of the month. We'll see you soon.